This is Shambhala Sun editor of web publications Rod Mead Sperry, and you're listening to Shambhala Sun Audio. Along with yoga and Buddhism, caregiving is one of the themes of our July 2009 issue, and also of several online exclusives at Shambhala Sun Space. It's important stuff. All of us will be touched by the illness and deaths of loved ones, so it only makes sense that Buddhists have always placed a premium on the practice and skill of caregiving. Truly notable among caregiving's modern Buddhist advocates is Frank Ostaseski, a co-founder of the Zen Hospice Project, the first Buddhist hospice in America. He is also the creator of the Metta Institute, located in Sausalito, California, whose mission is to seed our culture with innovative approaches to end-of-life care that reaffirm the spiritual dimensions of dying. You'll soon have an opportunity to engage Frank in an online Q&A on Shambhala Sunspace, wherein he'll take your questions about caregiving, illness, and dying. We'll share more details about that on July 6th, when the Q&A begins. First, though, let's introduce you to him via this short Shambhala Sun audio clip. As you'll hear, he's fascinating, trustworthy, and he knows what he's talking about from, as he says, both sides of the sheets. Frank, you co-founded the Zen Hospice Project in 1987. You've been doing this for a while. I'm curious how your work has evolved. You mentioned when we were first in contact that you became interested in doing something more extensive.
I'm a kind of spiritual pragmatist, Rod. I've lived in spiritual centers, et cetera, et cetera. But what really interests me is how do we take our Dharma practice and bring it into pragmatic application, particularly in the relationship of service. This really interests me. When I started Zen Hospice, I thought there was a natural match between people who were cultivating what I might call the listening mind in meditation or the listening heart and those who really need to be heard at least once in their life, folks who are dying. In this case, folks who were living on the streets and dying. And so I'm not interested in sort of making a big deal about it. I think there's a kind of naturalness in it. But there is, in the relationship of service there's an extraordinary opportunity for both the caregiver and the person in the bed to wake up. And the conditions are incredibly supportive of that possibility. You know, sickness, old age, and death is supposedly the foundations of our practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of talking about dying and, you know, the sort of esoteric dimensions of it. But what's really important is to talk about the day-to-day. You know, when I'm sick, and I mean, for example, I had this in the last year. I had a heart attack last year, so I was laid up and I had people taking care of me. And the view from the other side of the sheets is really interesting. I mean, an example would be when I was in the hospital, everyone around me, including my friends, by the way, but certainly the healthcare workers, the nurses and doctors were there, were all future-oriented. In an effort to try and help me, their protocols, their language, their manner with me was all oriented toward, it's going to get better.
Mm.
And while that was, in one way, supportive, in another way, one can get so caught up in that it sweeps you out of the present moment. And so your capacity to actually deal with what's occurring in the present moment, the suffering, the difficulty that's there, is dramatically diminished. Well-meaning people do this with patients all the time. They very rarely are actually present with them and their suffering as it's existing. And I knew that for myself, if I was able to feel my suffering, my innate compassion would emerge for me and I would be fine. But when I'm swept away into the future, I'm not in contact with myself. And so therefore, all of the, you know, my innate resources aren't available to me.
Right. Is it safe to say that this episode changed how you do what you do?
I'd say it's clarified it, you know, is another way to say it. I mean, I was doing... You know, these were ideas, obviously, and ways of behavior have been for me for 25, 30 years. But there's a refinement in that as a result of being on the receiving end of it. You know, I was the helper, then now I was the helpee, you know. And so, you know, I could feel it. I felt the visceral experience of when there was contact, when there was true presence, and when there wasn't. When you're sick, you can sniff out sentimentality and insincerity, and you yell bullshit. You know, you have no tolerance for it. So I guess when I say I'm interested in doing something more extensive, it's something that pragmatic, something that really utilizes our Dharma practice, but helps people see its application in the day-to-day exchange with somebody who's sick.
Mm.
That's part of it. The second part of it is to speak to how the conditions of dying are conducive, helpful to people waking up, for both the caregiver and the person that's dying. I mean, if I'm the person that's dying, for example, one of the things that's happening in that dying process is my sense of identity is being stripped away. It's being either stripped away by illness or it's gracefully being given up, but it's going. All the ways I've defined myself, I'm a father, I'm a Buddhist teacher, whatever it is, you know, they're all going. And then I have to ask myself the fundamental question, now who am I? And while not everyone would use that language, everyone meets those conditions, whether they're a Buddhist teacher or someone living on the streets. And I've worked with both of them. They inevitably meet that experience. Sometimes they meet that door and they turn away and, you know, watch the Wheel of Fortune on TV because it's just easier. But sometimes, with encouragement, they can go toward that door. Or all of us will face this door. Not all of us will go in.
And you're saying that any one of us has it innately inside of us to encourage that?
Absolutely. And I would even say, as caregivers, it's our responsibility to encourage it without imposing it. That's a fine line, but a really important one. In other words, it's not my job to impose on somebody else how they should die or to, you know, assert my Buddhist belief or any other belief. However, if I'm confident in this territory, if I'm abiding in it, I'll say, then what will happen is the other individual, while they might not be able to articulate, will recognize something in me that is trustworthy. And they will go to places that would have seemed otherwise too scary to go toward. Not because it's safe, but because they will be accompanied there. And that kind of rooted, available, present companionship is invaluable in the time of dying. And it doesn't have to be a therapist or a Buddhist teacher to do that. I've trained ordinary volunteers, people who were, you know, clerks in stores and lawyers in law offices to do that. And they have done a remarkable job at it. There's a deeper story here about what do the contemplative practices have to offer the experience of dying, and not just giving them, you know, Tonglin practice or Poa practice. I mean, that's great for people who want those things, but the average Joe needs something very different. The average Joe needs confidence at the bedside, and confidence can't be in our concept. It has to be in our direct experience.
That was Frank Ostasevsky joining me to talk about caregiving and practicing with illness. Visit Shambhala Sun Space on July 6th for a second Shambhala Sun audio clip featuring Frank, and to participate in an online Q&A with him about the topic. For more, you can also visit our special Caregiving and Practicing with Illness page or the current issue page on ShambhalaSun.com. This is Rod Mead Sperry, and thanks for listening to Shambhala Sun Audio.